Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome back to Building the Good Life for All, Transforming Income Inequality in Our Communities. That's right. So we began this conversation last week by taking a look at just kind of the reality of income inequality, and specifically looking at the working poor, who are those people that we're going to refer to by an acronym. We'll call them either ALICE, which means asset limited, income constrained, employed, or ALEC, because this is not just a matter of women. Asset limited, employed, constrained. So again, what it means to be asset limited, income constrained, employed. To be employed means that you do work that you get paid for. Lots of people do work, lots of people get paid for things. There is a set of people who do work that they get paid for. And that's what we mean when we say employed. To be income constrained, means, especially for these purposes, that you're making little enough money that it's really difficult to make ends meet. So we know that there's a federal poverty line that's defined by family size. So there's a federal poverty line, but then there's the amount of money it actually takes to survive according to kind of the established standard of living. So to pay rent, to pay utilities, food, medical care, all of those things. The poverty rate is not actually a particularly good metric of that, in part because it's federal and survival budget depends on where precisely you live, and partly because the federal poverty rate is primarily keyed to the cost of food, and the cost of food is kind of disproportionately low relative to the other things that are part of my and your budget. So that's income constrained. And asset limited means that you don't have that safety net. You don't have that cushion underneath you for when, for instance, your car breaks down or, God forbid, you're hospitalized. There's not the level of assets that it takes to be able to dip into those on occasion and then replenish them later on. If your income is constrained, it's hard to replenish them later on. It was hard to build them in the first place. So to be asset limited, income constrained, and employed. So we are talking about the working poor here. And we will call them Alice and Alec kind of interchangeably. The other point that was made last week was that we are interdependent with one another and interdependent with the working poor. So we talked about a number for the survival wage in Iowa had been, through research, established at about $16 an hour for a two-income family of four. So for a two-income family of four, about $16 an hour, which, you know how to do the quick math about hourly wage to annual salary, right? $16 an hour is about $32,000 a year. TSA workers who are under stress right now because they're required to work and not being paid for it and increasingly calling in sick because what's the point in going to work? There's a lot of stress in that role. They make about $35,000 a year. So they're just above that Iowa survival wage. They're not making ends meet in Chicago, in New York, in Atlanta. So there you've got one of those places where airports are starting to make contingency plans for what do they have to do if they have to shut down security checkpoints because they don't have enough TSA workers to staff those security checkpoints. There's one of the ways that our way of life and the way of life of the working poor are interconnected. So there's your current events for the week. We're going to turn now in chapter 2 to a spirituality of flourishing. So Shannon Jung, the author here, makes the point that this conversation about income inequality is not simply a material question, but actually a lot like the case that was made in the book by Liz Theo Harris that we read in the fall. The relationship between our material welfare and our spiritual welfare, those are very tightly tied together, in fact. And the spiritual welfare of a community is related to, not exclusively, but is also related to the way that material situations are distributed across that community. So this will be part of Shannon's argument here. In chapter 2, a spirituality of flourishing. Hey, I asked you for homework last week, though. Did anybody get to know any more about Alice and Alec in your communities, in the areas that you are connected to? Oh, yeah, choir members. You are at a disadvantage because you didn't know about the homework. So I want to just keep these questions in our mind as we go through this conversation. Who are our neighbors in need? What are their needs and desires? And how is our flourishing connected to our neighbor's flourishing? How is our flourishing connected to our neighbor's flourishing? We want to talk about a spirituality of flourishing this week. My approach to offering sort of summaries of these chapters is that I'm going to read sort of isolated sentences here and there to sort of string together a quicker snapshot of the argument in the chapter here. So Shannon begins, "I volunteer at an agency in Bradenton, Florida called Turning Points. There I see a lot of homeless people, a lot of Alices, and a lot of people who are temporarily down on their luck. I hear some amazing stories of people whose lives have been turned around by the help they find there. Helping others to thrive feels incredibly worthwhile to me. It is not altruistic, nor does it make me feel superior. The sense of flourishing comes from a feeling that what I am doing is worthwhile and contributes to people's well-being. We may consider ourselves to be flourishing if our own families are safe and well-fed, but the truth is that we cannot fully flourish when the least among us are not safe and well-fed. This is an issue of spirituality. In the face of inequity, many people live in fear that their own well-being may be threatened, or possibly as a result of such fear, they adopt a stance of looking after themselves alone, acquiring more and more to add to their comfort." So these two responses to the reality of economic insecurity, either our own or the way that the recognition of someone else's economic insecurity actually undermines our own sense of security. The two responses that he identifies are fear and consumerism. So on the matter of fear, he quotes a story by Henry Nouwen, who was a Catholic priest who wrote about really deep and personal spiritual matters. Henry Nouwen tells a parable that captures some of the ways being fearful impacts us. He says, "Once there was a people who said, 'How can we be sure that we will have enough in hard times?' So they started hoarding, gathering up as much as they could get. But then the fearful hoarders became even more fearful because they became afraid that the poor and the hungry, those who did not have enough, would attack them. And so they built up defenses around themselves. But instead of feeling safe and secure, they found themselves trapped in the prison they had built with their own fear. And gradually they realized that their fear of death had brought them closer to it." That parable is told in full on page 21, so I'm glancing over a lot of the narrative there. But this fear that leads us to build up defenses around ourselves, the defenses themselves can actually make us more fearful. And as Shannon says, fear is the opposite of flourishing. He also points to consumerism, which, again, he says may be an outgrowth of that fear. All of us, the working poor and the comfortable and the wealthy, live in a consumerist culture. Our individualism is taught and reinforced by consumerism, which has deep roots in our fear of loss. Both rich and poor live under the illusion that happiness lies just beyond the next purchase. Consumerism is an especially pernicious and deep-rooted disease for the affluent because their freedom to consume can be taken as a substitute for interdependence. Their own limitedness and dependence can be more easily disguised for them. So what we can buy is not actual independence. What we can buy is the illusion of independence. Shannon continues, serving the master of self, that is, buying what we need or think we need in order to meet those needs, serving the master of self leaves us feeling isolated and unhappy. If we are to follow God, we learn to share and find that rather than being diminished, we are strengthened by this sharing. So since our view of flourishing may be distorted by the two responses just explored, fear and consumerism, it's necessary for us to consider what exactly is involved in genuine flourishing. What constitutes flourishing? Americans value work and contributing to one's own and the public's well-being and freedom of opportunity. These all point to and rest on the creation of a society where all people have access to a decent standard of living. The bedrock for flourishing is having the necessities of life, including food, shelter, and companionship, along with security from immediate threat. A second broad element of flourishing has to do with realizing our value as human beings. Every person is loved by God, and God yearns for our love in return. A community communicating respect can offer the working poor a chance to see themselves in a light that does not equate worth with income. Being treated with basic justice or fairness is a third element of flourishing. A sense of deprivation can give rise to resentment and crime, and the blissful ignorance of the privileged leads to callousness and protectionism that ignores the realities of the working poor's situations. The fourth and most important aspect of flourishing, Shannon says, is shalom, or the vision of a loving, joyful, mutual community. Social connection is so much at the heart of us that we wither in the absence of mutuality. Community is characterized by contentment, peace, and joy. How does that sense of what flourishing is strike you?
When I read, I thought of Tennessee Drop.
Mm-hmm.
Because while they're not all on the same economic level, which is clear when you visit, I would say most of the time they're probably flourishing based on those four characteristics.
Yeah, So even in the presence of some economic inequality, and that's an important point that Shannon returns to again and again, that some level of economic inequality is one of those natural outgrowths of the way that skills and opportunity are unevenly distributed. But there's a level of economic inequality that calls for being addressed by a community for the sake of flourishing. A community where people can work and make a contribution, where people can realize that they are valued, where there is a measure of justice and fairness, that what I put in has some bearing on what I will get out, and that there is loving, joyful, mutual community where people are are connected to each other.
Is there more give and take between the members of the village, that some have more than others? Is there still more of a give and take or sharing?
I would say so. I mean, I think the probably the ones that have a little bit more money maybe give a little bit more. Like when we left, we got a chicken from one maybe family that had more money. Whereas for others, we might get some of the vegetables that they have in the garden. So, you know, the ones that have more give a little bit more. But I think across the board,
yeah,
I would say it was pretty fair.
Yeah, and there's a piece of that is that we're able to tell because of the scale of the community and the way that the community is knit together. We can tell that the chicken is coming from someone who has a chicken to spare and the vegetables are coming from someone who does not have a chicken to spare. And you know, there's no utopia, right? There's I'm sure, tension built into those relationships, but there is also the understanding that that if you don't have as much to give, not as much can be expected in that sense.
Well, it seems like, too, that they're so poor that, I mean, they really depend on each other. I mean, they have to, as a community, to survive, and they really support each other.
Right, so the reality of interdependence is more explicit in San Ysidro than it is, say, in West Des Moines, right? Because in West Des Moines, we depend on each other, we just pay each other for it, right? We may or may not pay each other for it fairly. That is its own set of questions that's built into this reality of economic inequality. But we are just as dependent on each other, but we depend on each other by mail, right? We don't depend on each other face-to-face in the same way. And the ways that we depend on each other face-to-face are still, they're mediated through that exchange of money most of the time, but they're also mediated by, you know, class and status and all of the other ways that are sort of built in to how we interact with each other. So it's not even that San Ysidro is more dependent on each other. It's just more obvious that they're dependent on each other.
When I was working at a grocery store in high school, I had a colleague, another student basically, asking the question. He said, I don't even remember his name, but I remember the question. He said, who would you miss first if they fired all the CEOs or if they fired all the waste collectors?
Right. No waste collectors, right? Yeah.
Very current.
Yeah.
So we are deeply interdependent with one another. And so this is a book about community. Now, how do we work toward flourishing? How do we, as individuals and groups of people, how do we work toward flourishing? So we've seen what blocks flourishing. Fear and consumerism, for instance. We now turn to the question of what could motivate our development of a spirituality of flourishing. These categories come from theologian Dawn Nothwer, who has explored the question of how spiritual transformation happens. And she identifies these key elements that are involved in transformation toward flourishing. There is recognition and confrontation of spiritual malaise. So in this case, that means repenting of our typical coping mechanisms, which are fear and consumerism. There are additional coping mechanisms that are also part of this. You might be able to categorize them under fear and consumerism. You might identify others as you go through the week. Don't try this at home, but identify where you're coping with the instability that is part of our economic life together. So confronting that, identifying that, repenting of that, to use Christian terms. And then there is supportive community. Two things that are vital to flourishing happen in groups. We must make ourselves vulnerable to those whom we trust will maintain our confidentiality and continue to relate to us. and others must make themselves vulnerable to us. This is how we learn that others care for us and that we can care for them. Generosity and gratitude. Generosity tends to nourish love in the giver, and love stands at the heart of human flourishing. So generosity naturally tends to promote human flourishing. And then there is identification with God. If we identify with what God is doing, if we can say, here's what God is doing and I am part of that, then our lives are suffused with a higher purpose. And in trust, we can live in harmony with God and nature and others. So there's a deep spiritual component to that work of spiritual transformation. Building on the transformative spirituality we have described in this chapter, we desire to be formed into people who are generous, who care, who are grateful, and who live out that gratitude. Henry Nouwen again, all Christian action is a manifestation of the human solidarity revealed to us in the house of God. It is not an anxious human effort to create a better world. It is a confident expression of the truth that in Christ, death, evil, and destruction have been overcome. So chapters 1 and 2 have been intended to lay a spiritual groundwork for the work that we do in our community. Efforts to serve the poor all by themselves will fall flat without a true understanding of the interconnectedness of human flourishing. The reciprocity of flourishing is something we have to learn. The well-off must learn what it means to be generous without being patronizing or paternalistic. On the other hand, Alice and Alec must sense that they have something to offer to the flourishing of the well-off. We must be interested not just in good intentions, but in the effectiveness of programs designed to promote the flourishing of others. That's where we will head next week, is to specific approaches to supporting the flourishing of others. So as we turn toward discussion, any sort of immediate responses to what Shannon has said in this chapter?
One of the Joppa representatives was quoted in the news this week about the gentleman that was killed by someone with a car this week, about how he was flourishing in the homeless community. He was homeless himself. He was spreading joy
through
his interaction with the homeless.
Right.
And that he was really a good person. And
yes. Yeah. And so there is such a thing as a homeless community, that it is a group that gathers most of the people in what one could call the homeless community are themselves homeless, but there are some who sort of enter into that community in a trustworthy way, and folks who enter into that community really recognizing and identifying with the people in that homeless community are able to actually say, hey, there's a real community here, right? Mm-hmm. People are recognized, they're understood. Now, there are all kinds of stresses on that community, and the stresses on that community are related to the fact of being homeless, right? Being homeless is a terribly hard thing to survive. There is also a community there. So when we can't, in a one-to-one way, identify economic well-being with the well-being of a community, because it's more complicated than that, right? It would be easy to say all we have to do is get those homeless people out of homelessness and get those poor people out of poverty and just sort of program changing the well-being of a community. But it doesn't change the well-being of the community directly that way. It can help, right? But the gentleman who was killed in an apparent hit and run this last week is one of those who, I never got to talk to him, I don't know. He may have very much wanted to be housed and still have the kinds of relationships that he had with folks, but he was building relationships with folks in the context he was in, whether he at that point wanted to be housed or not. Yeah.
The Java organization downtown, is part of that and has contributed a lot to that,
right,
as well. We've taken some things down there, and members of the community are clustered around there.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Marilyn?
Well, I was thinking to add to what Carla said, the San Ysidro motto has been from the start that we need to go there and see about their flourishing, what they feel they need.
Right.
And to meet with their leaders. And that has been at times misunderstood, that why don't you take the $700 per delegate, the cost of their airline ticket, and give it to the community. And it appears that we're talking here about the need to be there and to witness and to listen and to see and to respond according to their directiva, what they feel their needs are.
Right, yeah, and we're gonna talk next week. Our first strategy is relief, so directly meeting the needs of the working poor. So that's things like food pantries, that's also things like sending financial assistance to another community. Which is that, why do we spend $700 flying down there and back, right? That $700 could do more there. It could do a great deal there. But there are drawbacks to that strategy of relief as well. And one of the drawbacks is that lack of connection and responsiveness to the needs of the community. So each of the strategies that we talk about are gonna have drawbacks. They can be done better, they can be done worse, and they work in some situations and they don't work in other situations. That's going to be vital for us to understand. The idea that we are interconnected, I would go to the mat for. The idea that any particular way of responding to that interconnection, those sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work. They work in certain ways, they have certain drawbacks. There's no magic bullet for the fact of our interconnection and the inequality that we face.
And that, by the way, was a commercial for the fact that San Ysidro is our socios group is going to begin recruiting for the next delegation.
That's right.
Probably everybody recognized that, because that is a ongoing process of getting people who are willing to go see how they flourish, see what they need. Mm-hmm. But right now, I don't know how many students are starting on the school year in January. But I do you remember, Warren, how much we sent down for scholarships for?
I think we sent about 2,400, similar to last year.
Okay.
$200 a year for high school students, $100 a year for middle school students.
And the glitch that we are aware of, because we go and talk, is that some of our high school graduates can't find work. And they can't afford to move out of the community, and so they stay with the family farm. But our hope still is to follow up with those families, and there is that numerical possibility, and see how we know their names if they found jobs yet. I think that personal.
Right. So there's this personal interconnection. There's the reality that the material situation is always more complicated than we can picture from where we stand. So how are material flourishing and spiritual flourishing related? So how is our spirituality affected by our material circumstances? How is our spirituality affected by someone else's material circumstances? There's three huge questions to open up with.
Kayla gave a very good example about by her going there and actually experiencing the village and so on, this made her very spiritually ready to work for that cause.
Yeah.
Why are you speaking of Betty? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Sometime ago, Kayla mentioned that because she had been there,
okay.
And she saw that, you know, she understood what they needed.
Right. So to see and interact with the people of San Ysidro is a motivating factor toward that work of service. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's one of the ways that other people's material circumstances affect our spiritual life. Because
that
it calls
here
us.
Too.
Yeah.
When we go to the Ronald McDonald House, when we're in the hospital visiting people, whenever you're around other people and giving to them, your spirituality is increased somehow.
Yeah.
That's a really heartfelt thing.
Yeah. So building those relationships across what are otherwise divides of material circumstance, right? Your material circumstances affect where you go, where you feel welcome, on sort of at every level, right? That going down to Joppa is like crossing a border, right? Depending on where you're coming from. Going into a restaurant with tablecloths on the table is like crossing a border, depending on where you're coming from.
Not to be Debbie Downer on this whole thing, but I think that a lot of it is going to need to be attitude change.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's, every time you talk about assisting the working poor, whatever it is, so many times when I've heard people say, well, we need to do this, we need to do that, it's always based on what their opinion is of what needs to be done. The mm-hmm. other thing is, it's always got a criteria that's, oh, well, you can have this money, but you can't spend it that way. Mm-hmm. You have to spend it the way I want you to spend it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's interaction. I think you go back to the fear thing with, which I'd be real happy to find out the way to get around that, of doing something like you're talking about, mm-hmm. walking into an uncomfortable situation.
Right.
And how you're going to be received, how you're going to be perceived, and it's all an internal thing.
Mm-hmm.
So my concern on a lot of this is how do you go about changing some of those inner preconceived ideas about how somebody should react to you.
Right. And I'll say that those inner preconceived ideas and the idea that I'll give you money and you should do with it what I think you should do with it works kind of, that dynamic is there regardless of what I think you should do with it is, right? If I think, well, here's some money, you better use that to get a real haircut and get a real job, right? Or here's some money, you better use that to buy whatever most nutritious baby formula you can for this family that you have, or whatever the approach is. There's that same kind of whatever it takes to keep you out of my car, right? you ever get to be the first one in the left turn lane? So you're right next to the person flying the sign?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
And does that sort of calculation ever go through your mind? Like, are my doors locked? Right? That, I would argue, is a way that the reality of our own material well-being and someone else's material well-being, when they come up against each other, that fear that comes up is a piece of our spiritual makeup.
Well, and then there's on top of it,
yeah,
the resentment that can come. If you're in the left lane and you have the window, well, for example, I can give you an example from, if you were to offer a person a gift card to McDonald's.
Uh-huh.
That is not cash.
Uh-huh.
That's making them go to McDonald's to get something to eat, where they'll say, I'm hungry and I really need
right.
something to eat, and they turn you down.
Uh-huh.
Then you're like, well, okay,
yeah.
I'm
right.
not going to try again because, you know, forget it, you
right.
don't want any help.
So right.
It's just kind of, I mean, those kinds of situations come up, and those they seem to be the primary thing.
Uh-huh.
You don't hear about the successes; you hear about the
right.
ones where.
Right, and that's a evolutionary cognitive bias, right? That we are, for evolutionary reasons, biased toward that person is going to reject my help or mug me. Right? Which really, like, if we are giving to someone flying a sign on the street corner out of fear that if we don't, something worse will happen, right? That's basically like a voluntary mugging. You know, we're saying, I choose to be scared enough of you that I will give you $5 to make sure that even you just don't look at me bad, right? But there is also this, well, it's not going to work anyway, right? They're gonna reject the McDonald's gift card, or they're going to convert the McDonald's gift card into cash and walk next door to the liquor store, or whatever the thing is, right? Because we've got these biases toward something bad will happen. That's built into us, which calls for the spiritual transformation of really getting to know not obviously everyone we interact with. We live in an environment where we don't have time to deeply get to know everyone we interact with, but to get to know more of the people we interact with, so that we have a bigger repertoire of reasons someone might be asking for what they're asking for, or responding to us in the way that we're responding.
We haven't really mentioned, but I think the whole border wall issue is just filled with all the things we just talked about. Fear, preconceived ideas, and a total disparity in income, overspending. I mean, you could probably preach on that for a whole year. I mean, I think that is the ultimate example, or a real clear example of what you're talking about.
So, I am not right now prepared with the facts and the analysis to be able to speak coherently on that, to be honest. What I will say is that to the extent that our responses to that border wall, the presence of the border, the fact of the economic and opportunity inequality that drives the immigration across that border, to the extent that our response to that is based on fear, we are going to get our responses wrong. Fear of people of color coming up through the border, fear of what it means for our identity as a country, if we do build the wall, if we don't build the wall, fear of the ways that we have that conversation with each other, to the extent that we are responding based on fear, we are going to get that response wrong. To the extent that we are responding based on genuine, deep, and well-informed compassion, we are going to respond better. And I don't have the well-informed to the extent that I am able to say, here's the way to respond, right? I can say, we are called to compassion. I can say, we are called to welcome the stranger. That's me speaking to Christians. How are we called to welcome the stranger? How are we called to respond to the fact of that inequality? That's why we've got at least four strategies going on here. But that's a sight of that response to the inequality. So that's like our national car window, right? Our personal car window is when you have to be the first person in the left turn lane. Our national car window runs from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico. And to the extent that we respond from fear in either of those situations, we are spiritually on shakier ground.
Some politicians are talking, a lot of them are talking about this, the wall is not the image that we want to share with the world about what we're about in the United States. We have always welcomed people and tried to help them. So there is a lot of that image sort of thing, and maybe some of that is political too. But there seems to be a feeling that this isn't who we are.
Let me say that when I am out in public and I snap at my kids, I catch myself and check to see whether I'm wearing my cross. Because one of the things I am deeply fearful of is how I am perceived by other people. So we have to, whatever it is we believe about that particular issue or any other political response, personal response, community response to the reality of inequality and the effects of inequality, whatever we believe about that, it is necessary for us to interrogate where are we responding out of fear? And what do we really long for? Right? What are we really longing for? Or as Shannon would put it, what's the good life? What is the good life that we actually want for ourselves and for other people? If we can't want it for someone else as well, then it's probably not actually the good life, right? It's probably consumerism. If I want everyone in the world if I want myself to have like my favorite fanciest car, right? And I don't want that for everyone else in the world, then that's probably actually not the good life. That's actually probably not realistic for a number of reasons, both material and environmental. So that's probably actually not the good life. Adequate transportation sounds pretty important to me for everyone. See how I'm sort of trying to parse that difference? So how would you define the good life?
Well, the good life for one section of society is not going to necessarily be what is perceived as a good life for another section.
So there is a need for a great deal of humility in defining the good life. That we can't necessarily just stand where we are and say, this is what the good life would be for everyone. You're right. There is a need to understand where someone else is coming from, and perhaps to learn from them what the good life looks like in their case. How would you define the good life?
I think a significant measure of satisfaction is satisfaction with what your life is.
Okay, yeah.
And makes it the good life.
And I would venture that another word that might click in the place that you've got the word satisfaction might be the word gratitude.
Yes.
We could do some psychological studies on how actually gratitude leads to satisfaction. It doesn't go the other way around. So practices of gratitude make us happier. Being happy does not necessarily make us grateful. So satisfaction or gratitude, I'm going to offer that those might be very closely related words. You may not hear them as related words. So this is me putting words in your mouth just like I told Betty not to do. What else would you put in your picture of the good life?
I think in terms of good life, in terms of flourishing, the model that I kind of go back to is Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Uh-huh.
And your basic need is warmth, food, shelter. Really, it's a level of existence where you're not consumed by just survival.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is psychological survival, because if your kids are sick, if you're not able to get what they need, whatever, you know, those things can interfere greatly on whether you're flourishing or whether you have a sense of well-being.
Yeah, so there is a physiological level to well-being that is necessary as kind of a ground floor for the good life.
And if I'm afraid I'm going to be addicted, mm-hmm. that's as physical as if I'm hungry.
Yeah, yeah. So Maslow was pretty specific about, food, shelter, security, right? Those are kind of all at one tier. There's actually a more fundamental level because there are things for which we would sacrifice food, shelter, and security. Like sex actually is more fundamental than food. Just watch deer during mating season, right? But that hierarchy and being stable on that hierarchy, Shannon did point to that as well. When he was talking about the ability to work and contribute, he said that fundamental to the ability to work and contribute is having your basic fundamental standard of living met, which, you know, to one side sounds like, yes, that's great, that's why we need more food stamps. And to the other side is like, wait, remember making a contribution, that's why we need to work with our food stamps, right? So this is one of the places where those priorities and values, even like at the same level, start to come into tension with each other. I don't think they're in conflict. I think there are ways to resolve that if only we would listen to each other. But yeah, so what do we need at that fundamental level to be able to contribute? How does God relate to our flourishing? And how does the community relate to our flourishing? So how does our flourishing depend on God? How does our flourishing depend on a community surrounding us?
Well, people in this room have heard me say this probably multiple times. I just wonder how people who do not have a church affiliation, like Covenant, function when the hard times come. We've all had ups and downs in our life. And to me, I just don't know. And we all know a lot of good folk who Sunday mornings, church is not part of their life. And I can't explain it. Don't need to have it explained to me. But for me, it's kind of like my dad was in the insurance business. You know, you kind of need to have that established ahead of time. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been in this church over 30 years, you know, and the relationships that I have here, hopefully I've not seen any more hard times coming. Those are all in the rear view mirror. You know, I am flourishing. I am, as Jerry said, to not be on that lower level of Maslow's, I've escaped that over time.
Right.
But people who do not have a church, who do not believe in a higher power, God, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know psychologically, mentally, how they function. Now, when things are going well, that's a piece of cake,
right?
But when the difficulties arrive, and they will, mm-hmm. how they function,
right?
Stumps me.
So there's so we talk about that that asset limitation, right? And part of the consumerist response to the fear of economic instability is to make sure that I have the financial cushion I need. One of the things that we do as church communities is think about, do we have the financial cushion we need, right? That I actually don't need the same amount of money in the bank in case of a rainy day. If I'm part of a church community where there's more reciprocity between the members of the community, I may have a bunch of money in the bank. That's a different question. But I don't actually need as much for my security if my security is shared with others around me.
I think I have to give you homework.
If you are the homework doing type, If you're not the homework doing type, I'm just going to say this into the wind. Chapter 3, we turn to our strategies. So our strategies again are relief, self-help, cultural formation, and advocacy and governmental action. So obviously churches themselves can't take governmental action, but we can advocate for it. We can't, one congregation by ourselves, form the culture, but we speak into that culture. Relief and self-help actually are a lot more within our reach as specific congregations. So we're going to start with relief. We're going to read about what, how does that work? How does it not work? When is it a useful way to contribute? When is it not a useful way to contribute? So thank you all for staying a little bit over today. We're all going to run to worship now.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.